better off.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to A Pod of Their Own. This is episode 30. I am Allison McCaig, and I am joined this week by my lovely co-hosts, Linda Surovich. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Allison.
And Maggie Wiggin. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Allison.
We are also joined this week by a special guest, Bradford William Davis. Hi, Bradford.
Yo, what's up?
So glad to have you on the show. This is awesome.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Bradford, for those of you who have been living under a rock and don't know who Bradford is, he is a senior writer at the New York Daily News, mostly covering baseball. He also does the Five and Dive podcast over at Baseball Prospectus, our very good friends at BP. You should check out that podcast and honestly their whole suite of podcasts because, you know, they're doing great over there. They just expanded their podcast effort and Bradford has been a part of that. So y'all should check that out. If you're already listening to this show and you aren't listening to those shows, what the heck are you doing? So we have Bradford on at a very opportune time because there's stuff happening in both the Mets world and the baseball world. So obviously the main thing that has happened with the Mets since we last recorded is that they finally hired their manager. Wow.
I didn't think they'd be able to stretch this show out to six seasons, but they did it. It's very impressive.
You know, I want to say we kind of spoke it. Yeah, we kind of spoke it into existence, though, because we kind of were screaming about it on Tuesday. And by Friday, I think they hired Beltran. So you're welcome, Metsland.
A prophet is among us.
Yeah, I think they also ended up going with Beltran because I said that I was scared of it. So I would like to think that I had some small hand in it. Just to be clear, I was not scared of it because I'm scared of anything about Carlos Beltran, except that I think he is wonderful and I am scared of what the Mets will do to him.
Yeah, will they break him a second time?
Damn it, they're going to try.
Will they blame him?
Yes.
They will blame him. Beltran
be blamed. Okay.
He will be blamed. So, Bradford, what do you think of the Beltran hire just, like, in general? What was your reaction to it?
Well, I mean, I think I'm happy to see Carlos Beltran, who, by all accounts, seems to be a genuinely kind, decent person, get the thing he wanted. For some reason, that thing he wanted was to manage New York Mets. You know, I can't say I completely understand it, except, you know what? The take I gave actually on Five and Dive was that he just kind of wanted to be in New York. You know, he had some sentimental tie to Mets, but the reason why he was only interviewing, you know, for a manager job in New York is because, you know, he wanted to stay here, which I get, you know, like he's been here for like a combined 12, 13 years off and on. Right. Besides that little stint in Texas, and San Fran, I guess. So, oh, in St. Louis, I'm sorry, but he's been spent most of his last few years here. So that's my inference, but nonetheless, like, you know, it seems like he genuinely buried the hatchet with, the Wilpons. Like I wouldn't advise that, but again, that's, you know, that's entirely, the team does have actually a very strong core. So there's a baseball reason to want to be with the Mets. You know, you can hope and dream that they kind of fell out the sort of the fringes of the roster in a way that they never do.
Wade Miley is just sitting there for the taking right now.
Maggie, no, don't put
Rick
that out
Porcello,
there.
Rick Porcello, big
and Julio Teheran now too.
You know what? Well, I mean, like, you know, the funny thing is I actually wouldn't mind for the Mets like an innings eater number five, as long as they just keep Wheeler around. But, you know, that's just my personal hunch. And I doubt that they'll do both. So, you know,
seems like a safe bet.
Yeah. But anyway, so I mean, like, you know, but he seems like a kind person. I think my understanding is that he is a fantastic leader of men. I remember really appreciating, though he should not have had to do this, I appreciate the leadership it took for him to advocate for other Latino baseball players, in the locker room when they had to go, you know, when they had to do pre and post game interviews, not only translating for them, with English speaking, you know, journalists, but saying this shouldn't be this way, like we need translators, and that is something that is really expanded across the league. So it's not just, you know, the high high profile Japanese imports that are getting translators, but like, you know, but a segment of major league rosters is like, you know, that makes up, you know, what, a third or whatever of the league at this point, right. You know? So I think that shows the kind of caliber of person he is, you know, caliber of leader, clearly someone who values the importance of good nuanced communication, that may be something that was lacking in the Mets clubhouse in recent years.
Nuance?
He's shown a comfortability with, you know, the new information that's available about how, you know, players can improve and, you know, and just, you know, be their best selves on the field. I think that's kind of cool as well. Like, you know, that he has that, you know, that he's comfortable with that he cares about it, and that he wants to use that to help, you know, inform the decisions and, you know, I guess the, you know, just the ways he encourages and motivates his, you know, his team to just be their best selves on the field. So I think that's dope as well. Like, yeah, I mean, I'm nervously excited to see how a Beltran-led Mets, you know, goes forward.
Do you think, since he just worked with the Yankees and seeing how a well-run organization is run, could that help him with an organization who might be lacking in that department?
Again, one of the reasons why I think half the reason he wants to be here is just because he wants to stay in New York. That, again, pure speculation. Because I'm like, you know, you just, like, you're leaving, you know, the Yankees for this, like, for, you know, and all of the many things that follow the Mets since the Wilpons took control, and, you know, well, wherever I was.
He was in that clubhouse with Girardi, right? Like, they, so, I mean, if he's picking up on any, you know, Yankee skills, we're trying to think of, like, the word for what the Mets don't have, then, like, Girardi is not a bad guy to be picking stuff up from. You know, it'll be interesting to see if he kind of has that low-key persona that I think could really work for him in the right spot.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think that isn't a good thing, because Girardi, I think, was a pretty solid tactician. Throughout majority of his career, he had some, you know, numerous mistakes, but kind of everyone does if you're, you know, managing long enough.
No managers are good.
But, but you know, the other thing with Girardi is his communication was what was criticized in the latter Yankee years. You know, the people, there were a lot of, you know, murmurs that he wasn't connecting well with guys like Gary Sanchez, who is, you know, very critically important to the Yankees' future. You know, that there were, you know, just that he was, you know, he was at times very tense, with the press, or, you know, and perhaps with his players. Again, not a bad person, you know, and I think a lot of things about his communication that I really liked. I love the way that he defended his players as well in the press, like Alex Rodriguez, when no one would defend him, when everyone, before the rebrand, before J-Lo, before A-Rod Corp, and the fancy suits, and, you know, and the Fox Sports analyst stuff, like, when everyone hated Alex Rodriguez, Joe Girardi stood up for him every time, and I really, really admire that. And so, you know, so it's not like I'm not saying he's a bad person or anything like that, far from that. But that, you know, as far as this is, you know, that some of those important soft managerial skills were not things that he was lauded for, at least towards the end of his time in New York. So, but Beltran seems to have those things that Girardi does not, or did not, at least reputationally. So perhaps he's learning by example in, you know, an indirect way of, like, how to, you know, build upon the leadership that he's had in the past.
Yeah, I think despite the fact that nervously excited, as you put it, is how I think most Mets fans would describe how they feel at this time, I think that the thing that gives me, like, the most, you know, the thing that makes me calm at the end of the day is that he knows exactly what he's getting into with this job. Like, he has no illusions about what the Mets are. Like, he knows it. He's been through it before. And so, you know, even though the Mets have the potential to, you know, screw him up again, I think he knows that that's the risk that he's taking with this job, and the fact that he's prepared to take that on is like, well, okay, he's ready, I guess.
Yeah, he signed all the consent forms. Like, he's a grown-ass man who is hitching his horse to this wagon.
Well, and I think what we saw with Mickey Callaway is you need experienced people around you, which Mickey Callaway definitely did not have at first. So I'm kind of torn about the rumors of Terry Collins going around as the bench coach. Because at the end there was that Mark Craig article where it seemed like once all the veterans were gone, the clubhouse completely turned on Terry Collins because he relied on the veterans so much. So I feel like you both need experience and somebody who can relate to the younger guys. And I don't know if Terry Collins is that person.
But maybe Beltran's that person already.
That's true.
Because he has the auto credibility, you know. If you're, you know, the millennial age, as we were talking about pre-podcast, right? We all grew up, you know, watching Carlos Beltran hit monster playoff home runs and, you know, and incredible grabs in center field and stuff like that. We all, you know, saw that. And then some, you know, and some of those players got to compete with him and see his intelligence, his talents, you know, even as an older ball player. So he's kind of like, he's kind of got that, I think, already on his own. I think it also, regardless of whether or not it is the wisest choice, I'm not entirely sure, you know, where to weigh in as far as Terry Collins. I think it would be a pretty boss move to make someone who used to be a manager your bench coach. Like, that's dope. I can't in front of that. That's awesome. That's kind of like what Jason Kidd did with the Brooklyn Nets and making Lawrence Frank his
coach.
When he used to, that was actually worse because he actually used to play for Lawrence Frank. And he was, you know, and then I made him his assistant. So I kind of like that as far as jokes and slander. but that's half the reason I watch sports anyway. So
yeah, certainly from like, and if you're like at the point where you're like, you know, I'm just in this for irony. Like, I just feel like the entertainment factor of like Carlos Beltran manager, Terry Collins bench coach is just like off the charts. So at least there's that.
Exactly. Thank Terry you. Collins is a bit.
It is a bit.
Yeah.
And, like ass back in the jackpot. So like, it would just be funny to watch like Terry Collins out there, like being Terry Collins. And I feel like, you know, it would make a good kind of team in the sense that Beltran does have that kind of quiet intensity about him. And actually, I think it was Mickey Callaway was criticized early in his managerial tenure for like not having enough quote fire. And then like when it came at a very bad time and inappropriately and poorly. And so like Beltran does have that kind of quiet intensity about him. And I trust him to not lose it in the same way that Mickey Callaway did and not like, you know, threaten a reporter. So
yeah, it doesn't really seem like his thing.
Yeah, no. But Terry Collins can bring that like more fiery, blustery side, I guess, to it.
Yeah. How much shorter than Beltran do you think Terry Collins is? Because I'm here for the visual. That just seems
it's not Aaron Judge, Jose Altuve, I'll tell you that.
Seems like it would be amusing. Yeah, no, not that amusing. That one still kind of scares me a little bit.
Well, Carlos is 6'1", 215, which is you know, a solid size.
All right, Terry Collins is like 5'4", so.
Okay, well, there you go.
Maybe not.
I wonder if I looked this up, if I could find it out. He's 5'9", according to the internet.
Okay, there we go.
Okay, that's just
okay, so bad. Well, you know, it'll be like, it'll be like that 5'9 girls, 5'9 guys meme. Where it's like one person looking down and shaking, you know, like a child's hand, and then the caption is 5'9 girls on the tall person side and 5'9 guys. That's what it'll be.
That's what it is. So, yeah, exactly.
5'9", wink, wink.
Well, not to put this out there too, but can you imagine interim coach Terry Collins?
Jesus Christ.
Or interim manager Terry Collins?
Let's not. I mean,
such a cursed line of thought.
That is a cursed line of thought.
It's always a possibility with the Mets.
They gave Beltran 3 years though, which I did not expect, with an option too.
Option.
Yeah, he must have really wowed them.
Yeah.
So. Especially since they're paying Mickey still, too.
Yeah. And, like, I don't know. I just, like, I had said going in that, like, of the remaining guys, like, after, like, Joe Girardi was kind of off the table, I said, of the remaining guys at this point, like Bradford said, we're kind of going for the entertainment factor, and Carlos Beltran is obviously the most, like, the best story of the remaining candidates, so that's what I wanted. And so I was like, okay, I'm happy with it. And I was kind of like, I'm nervous, but I'm happy. But then the second he put on the 15 jersey in the press room, I was like, I'm all in. I'm all in, guys. All in. I'm crying in the club. Here I am. Crying. It's happening.
Yeah, that was such a trip seeing him put the uniform on again.
The like side by side photos of him, like, yes, of him putting on the 15 in the presser when they signed him as a player, and him putting on 15 in the presser as the manager. That, like, that sent me. That just got me. I was like, all right, I'm in. I'm in. Because 15 is, like, because of Carlos Beltran, because, like, that's the player I grew up watching. Like, 15's my soccer number because of him. Like, he was my favorite baseball player while he was on the Mets. And just,
yeah,
like,
he was my favorite too.
So seeing him put on that 15, I'm just like, they better put that on sale in the Mets team store immediately, because this sucker right here is gonna buy it.
I mean, let's be real, he's not the worst internal option for center field right now.
Nope.
he's got about as much range
as all of the other options.
Yep.
Because we don't have Juan Lagares anymore, so yep. We don't have a true center fielder on the team. I mean, I'm fine with it, but you're right.
We
Maddie,
are like
in a pinch.
We are one Brandon Nimmo sleeping on his neck wrong away from Carlos Beltran in center field.
One Brandon Nimmo cooking fish wrong
Carlos
again.
Carlos Beltran.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Man. So, I think we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about Rookie of the Year and Cy Young Award stuff, because obviously that is the other most relevant thing happening with the Mets right now. As expected, Pete Alonso and Jacob deGrom were both announced as finalists for their respective awards, Pete for Rookie of the Year and Jacob deGrom for Cy Young. I think everyone on this podcast right now can agree that Pete Alonso is kind of the shoe-in for Rookie of the Year. It's just a question of this point whether he is unanimous or not. But Cy Young is a more interesting question, I think. And so, Bradford, what do you think are Jake's, like, chances at the Cy Young? Like, what percentage chance would you say that he wins?
I'd be, well before I say percentage chance, just speaking, like, my personal evaluation is I'd be pretty disappointed if he did not win. I think he was absolutely the best pitcher in baseball, in at least in the National League this year. And arguably the best pitcher in all baseball again. I think, you know, he truly, you know, the way he improved from June and onward was pretty, just kind of adding to his legend as one of the all-time greats and one of the all-time great Mets. I think, you know,
correct answer. You may stay on this podcast.
Oh, fantastic. all right. Slid on stage. But you know, I think that voters have gotten past, you know, win loss records, largely, you know, which is a good thing, because they're you know, in a single season, they're not the strongest indicator of, you know, how a pitcher performs. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir right now, but we all know it's true. You know, Ryu was incredible, but he was. You know, but if it's I think in a non-Tyberg situation, like, you know, which it is not a tie in my opinion. You know, I think you guys got to give it to Jake, percentage wise. So percentage wise, I'd say I give it like 70%. You know, I'm not totally surprised about an upset, but I think, you know, I think Jake's got it in the bag. He's got the narrative too after last year.
I think that's about where I'm at too, at about 70%. What would you two say?
I was kind of surprised Flaherty wasn't one of the finalists, just because he put together such an incredible second half that I thought maybe he had the narrative and the momentum going forward. But since he's not in it, I would have to give Jake, I would maybe bump it up a little higher to like 85%, because I think I even said this either on an earlier podcast or maybe I wrote it, he stuck the landing. Like, he didn't struggle in September like the others did. He was healthy, like, unlike the others. So what he left the voters with was an impressive amount of work at the end of the year. So if that was fresh in their minds when they were voting, I think they would have to give it to him. So maybe, or maybe I'm just biased and I'm hoping it's at 80%, which is also entirely possible, but that's just how, you know, I viewed it, is that, you know, the others just, I think Ryu had to stay under two in order to get serious consideration, because he didn't have the strikeouts, he didn't have the innings pitched, and I think his, all the other stats just don't add up to where Jake is. So yeah, that's where I'm at.
To kick myself off the pod real quick, I just want to give the quick intellectual case for Ryu.
Okay.
When I was looking at his stats today, and because, you know, he's a free agent again, and just as I'm preparing, you know, off-season comms and everything, his ability to induce weak contact was like the absolute best in the league, basically. And that's the kind of thing that, like, a lot of like the fan graphsy kind of like stats don't really capture, but is, you know, to his credit, truly great pitching. So while strikeouts, you know, like, strikeouts obviously met way more in my, in the way I evaluate, you know, good pitching. They are not the BR end all, you know, outs are. And if you're getting a bunch of pop-ups and can of corns and you know, just kind of hits that don't matter, especially in a rocket ball era where, like, everything was flying out of the park, but yet no one could hit hard, you know, no one could really square it up off of you, I think that is very impressive. So I do want to just give, you know, Ryu that credit, as someone who truly is a pitcher's pitcher when he's on the mound.
I might be making this up, but didn't he have some, like, ridiculous home run rate? Like, it was minuscule.
Yeah, I mean, I could pull up the stat now, but...
Yeah, because I remember, like, he was, like, the one person nobody could hit a home run off of.
I know he was in, like, the bottom... fifth, or I'm messing up percentile numbers because I'm an idiot, but he was in like the fifth percentile of like hard contact, which is good, because yeah, like if you were in the 95th percentile, that would be very bad. Allison, you're like a doctor, so you can you can correct me if I'm mistaken here, but
I mean, I like him a lot, and I like that he's a weird pitcher. I'm very pro weird pitchers, the R.A. Dickey school of thought. And like, if Jake has to lose to somebody, he would be my pick. But I hope Jake doesn't have to lose to anybody. So that would be my preference. I could definitely see him getting dinged by a little bias against two in a row. That's a fair winners. Human thing to feel. I mean, that's partly why R.A. Dickey won the Cy Young when he did, because it probably should have been Kershaw that year. But, like, definitely, if he can get over that hump, it should be his to lose. He had an incredible season. I loved watching him figure out the ball as he went along. It, like, he was so clearly taken aback by the change from the very beginning. Like, he had a really rough April, and it was really cool to just see him reteach himself how to throw a slider, like, on the fly. I mean, that's amazing. He's awesome.
That's exactly it. I think that's, you nailed it on the head, Maggie. That's exactly what made this Jake season really special for me. And what kind of sets it apart from his 2018, which was obviously like his most historic season so far, as far as just like the crazy, crazy numbers. But like, what made this season really special is like just watching him like figure it out. And that's what sets, you know, apart the like the pitchers from the throwers, is like the ability to adjust to things. And this year that was the baseball and how different it was, which we will get to in a future podcast. Stay tuned.
Hey.
But yeah, so he had a really horrible April, and that is the only reason why his ERA is like above two. If you look at his like basically from May on, like his stats are almost identical to 2018. So like, we thought after 2018, like, there's no way he could repeat that season. And he essentially did after April. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, outside of three starts, he was literally the same exact pitcher. Like the home run, the home runs went up a little bit, but I think that was kind of normal for the turbo ball. Yeah, and yeah, around the league. But also, I kind of feel we kind of get spoiled because I don't know if it's just his personality or something. Like he's not Syndergaard. He's not flashy. He's not brash. He doesn't like steal the spotlight. We just take his consistency for granted, and it's just the same thing day in, day out. And like all of a sudden at the end of the year you're like, oh, that was another really great year. Like you're just spoiled seeing him pitch every day, that you just kind of you kind of take him for granted, which isn't really fair to him because he is just so good. And he's probably the best pitcher of my lifetime that I've seen. Like every, you know, there are other pitchers have had great seasons like Ari Dickey and Matt Harvey, but to be consistently good like he has, it's probably for, you know, the millennial generation who did not see Doc Good, and it's probably has to be him.
Yeah, he's the best Mets pitcher in our lifetimes. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that's no contest. I was going to say best pitcher I've ever seen in my lifetime. If you expand that to all baseball teams, like probably peak Pedro. Like it's hard to argue. Yeah. That's peak Pedro.
Yeah. No. And Pedro, I think will always be my answer. Like,
yeah. Cause he did that during the steroid era too.
I could see myself dying, you know, well, that's way macabre, but I could see the entire span of my life, you know, answering the question, you know, who was the best pitcher you saw? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, 99-2000, Pedro Martinez. No one like him.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
Unreal. As far as Mets pitcher, he's going to surpass Gooden, I think, extremely soon. Yeah. You know, if his health continues to remain strong. I mean, it's really something. You look at his stats, like, he's never been anything less than awesome. Like, yep. It's, you know, and in a, you know, a famously stacked rotation, when he, you know, first came up as a kind of an older rookie, like with you know, Harvey and Syndergaard and Matt's even all, you know, upper echelon prospects who were tabbed as future aces, and yet
there's
it is him who is
there's some tweet where I like really like kind of nastily poo-poo the idea that the Mariners would ever trade the Mets. Was it like Nick Ahmed it was some like middling shortstop prospect, and I was like, first of all, they would never take Jacob DeGrom for him. And
oh,
then second
no.
of all, I mean, like, oh boy. I think it's my only pre-debut DeGrom tweet, and it's just it's not my finest work. I'm not proud of it. I can't say
old takes exposed.
But like, at least I never had to construct a prospect list that had him at, like, I don't know where people were putting him, like 12th. So I guess my failings on seeing DeGrom coming are not quite as in sharp relief as others.
Well, it seems like the Mets didn't even know what they had. They just bought him up and like to put him in the bullpen. And they're like, eh, we'll just throw him in there, see what happens. And I think Dylan G got hurt. And then they had G. to pitch it.
Well, and when he came up, we were like, he came up at the same time as Rafael Montero. And we were all losing it over Montero. Like, finally, he's getting his shot.
Right. That's so true. Jake was in the shadow of Rafael Montero. Imagine that.
Yeah, they pitched the same weekend. Montero made his debut, I think, like either Friday or Saturday, and then Jake made his debut the next day against the Yankees.
Yeah,
yep, that's right, against the Yankees.
And he wasn't great, but he also wasn't terrible. And as I recall, Montero was terrible, so it's nice to have a little balance.
I mean, Jake only gave up one run, and it was David Wright's fault that he gave up the one run because he didn't turn a double play because he got confused by the shift. But not that I've like studied this game to like the extreme, and I think Alfonso Soriano may have hit drove in the run. But
oh, I remember that now.
Yeah, but it was one run, seven strikeouts, I think 6 or 7 innings, so it was a good debut.
Man,
but then he didn't get a win in like his first 9 starts, because I remember thinking, this poor guy's pitching his little heart out and they're not getting him a win.
Get used to it, buddy.
Same as it ever was.
Yeah. So like, that was just, you know, a harbinger of thing to come.
I'll give you a an old take exposed of my own. I had a long, long G-chat argument with a friend of mine where I was thoroughly convinced that Michael Panetta was a better pitcher than Jake DeGrom.
Oh.
And that was like kind of late in the train too. That was like 2015.
Oh.
Because, you know, Michael Panetta had to start where he struck out 15 dudes in like 7-something innings. And I was like, oh, man, wow, this guy, he's next, you know? He's
the next. That'll get you believing.
Yep. And, you know, I ignored all the injuries, the DUI, the pine tar, probably all the diuretics that he was taking to mess the RPGs that he may have been consuming as well, you know, this 2019 test is any indication. And also the inability to keep batters on, which apparently is a useful skill in pitching.
Yeah.
You know,
the Mets like, know that intimately well, that pretty much all their pitchers, besides Jake is just like average at it, but like all their pitchers are bad at it, especially Syndergaard, of course.
Yeah, you know, pitchability matters. But that was like in my worst, you know, I only read Fangraphs bag. No shade to Fangraphs as a incredibly vital resource for kind of everything I do, but in understanding a lot of the nuances that, you know, help actually lead to on-field results, you know, looking at a FIP is not the end all be all, which again most Fangraph writers would certainly, you know, say and have said, but I'm just an idiot again. But yeah, so anyway, all I'll say is no one saw Jake DeGrom until Jake DeGrom was like 20 starts in and clearly, you know,
yeah,
a future ace.
I think it was the 8 consecutive strikeouts to start a game that we all started to realize, like, this is really, because I think the thing about that game was like, it was incredible, but then also it wasn't totally surprising. And when that happens and it's not totally surprising, that to me says a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think that it's funny. Like, I think that Pineda, that isn't even in like the, like, that's just part of one bucket of like the Yankees fan takes about DeGrom. Cause if you talk about all the trade proposals that have come out over like the past few trading deadlines of like what the Yankees would trade the Mets for Jacob DeGrom, there's some doozies in there. I mean, like, I bet the Yankees really wish that they had traded Miguel Andujar for Jacob DeGrom now.
Oh, man.
Or like Clint Frazier for Jacob DeGrom.
would have been a different playoffs for them.
Who says no? I'll hang up.
Who says no? I'll hang up and listen.
This is kind of off topic, but the best was Cashman saying Stroman wouldn't have even been good enough for their bullpen in the playoffs. He would have only been in their bullpen for the playoffs. And then they went for a bullpen game the day they got eliminated.
Oh my gosh, the arrogance. My man flew too close to the sun. right there. That was, you know, I will say this, because I need to stop negging myself as like a writer and thinker. But I did write a column about that as it happened, where I said something to the effect of if Chad Green isn't holding his arm, one of the soldiers in Saving Private Ryan, by the end of the ALCS, Brian Cashman will look smart. But if that doesn't happen, he's going to look really bad. And then what happened in Game 7? Exactly. Or Game 6, rather, the ALCS. He gives up a massive home run. Every single reliever in the Yankees is like, oh, man, we need, you know, we're burnt out. We're overexposed. You know, we're relievers. Zach Britton's like, we're relievers. You know, this is not how it's supposed to be used. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, the consensus after the Game 6 loss was that another starting pitcher would have been massively important, if just for the fact that the pen would have been had less use, less burn, so that they could be their best selves in Game 6 and Game 7. So, you know.
Wild that have good pitchers is a hot take now.
Isn't it? Ain't that something?
Yeah.
starting pitching wins.
Yeah, sign good pitchers.
It seems like the Yankees went about it backwards. They focused so much on their bullpen that they were like, starting pitching, But, like, you still need somebody to get those outs. And if your bullpen just isn't, you know, used to pitching that many innings, this is what's going to happen.
And Marcus Stroman made it very clear on Twitter.com that he thought it could have been him.
I love Marcus so much.
I mean, like, I kind of wish he just said, like, one tweet instead of, like, 20 retweets.
Like, and liking all the tweets.
When you start, like, sharing your war, like, that's a little corny to me. But, but nonetheless, I mean, he was genuinely disrespected, and I can't imagine being in his shoes. If, you know, Brian Cashman disrespected me, I'd probably be posting about it too. So, so darn it, I get it. I really think with the Yankees and with a lot of teams is they took what the Royals did, and they took the wrong lesson. Which is not that it's a bad idea to have a really great bullpen. You know, I'm talking about the 2014, 2015 Royals that, one was there. Oh, sorry. I'm talking to him. I guess no one remembers. Oh.
We'll put in a content warning in post-production, but yeah.
Yeah. Trigger warning, Mets.
That should have been the name of the podcast.
we're naming this episode Trigger Warning Mets.
Yeah, no, I knew as soon as he said it.
But the lesson was not that you should forego elite starting pitching for, to have a great bullpen. The lesson was how to cheaply build a pitching staff that could get the 27 outs, not necessarily the best foot forward for getting 27 outs. And even the Royals, they traded for James Shields, before they won the pennant in 2014. The only reason they didn't keep James Shields, and James Shields is like innings eater extraordinaire. That man was throwing like 230 innings a year, back when people did that. So, they let him walk only because they couldn't afford him, not because he wasn't an incredibly important part of that team that took the Giants to 7 games. And then midseason in 2015, they traded for Johnny Cueto, who's a very similar pitcher to James Shields, in that he's very good, but one of his, best strengths during his prime was that he can give you 7-8 innings of 2-3-run ball. And of course, what did he do in that World Series?
Yeah.
He threw game, one run, four hitter, whatever, I don't know, but some sort of like, excellent dominant performance. The kind of thing that lets you have the comfort to deploy your bullpen liberally later on. The Royals understood that starting pitching is extremely important, because they choose to operate within a certain budget, despite being another franchise worth billions, as the recent sale indicates. They chose to operate with a certain budget and they got away with it, which is great, good for that city and everything. But teams should be absolutely ponying up for pitchers that can give you length. So that Super Bowl pen that you want to build is most effective when it matters most, so that you can liberally deploy them because you have, your Verlanders or Strasburgs or whatever, giving you length. Like even that Justin Verlander game that he lost in the ALCS game 5, I want to say, he still threw 7 innings. Like that is valuable as far as like, he lost the battle, but they won the war because he gave them that depth that allowed their bullpen to be a little fresher and just a little bit better than the Yankees. So
I mean, 7 games is a long series.
It's
a lot easier to sneak through a 5-game series than a 7, because you cannot run even the hardiest relievers through 7 games. It just can't happen. You've got to start using the other guys at that point. And that's where, that's where you get burnt.
Yeah. I mean, it could work. Anything could work. The 06 Cardinals. Ah, shoot. There we go. The trigger warning Mets.
Come on, man. You're killing me here.
Oh, God. I'm sorry. But I'll get in and out of this. But, like, that's not a team that you would necessarily build to win a World Series, but sometimes Jeff Lever and Jeff Cipon, become ace level pitchers for, you know, 3 weeks, and that's kind of it. So, like, so just because it can work, you know, doesn't mean that it should. Or rather, doesn't mean that you should plan your roster for that. So I wish that other teams would do that, but there's too much profitability to be had and kept by, you know, constructing the most quote-unquote efficient, you know, roster that you can. And that's a pet peeve that I will probably write about until I am dead, to be intentionally macabre.
Please keep writing about it. And you know what? I think the take-home message from this entire, like, part of the segment is every team who is interested in competing should sign Garrett Cole, should be in on Garrett Cole. Mm-hmm. Every single mm-hmm. one. Including absolutely. The Mets. Please be in on Garrett Cole. They will not.
Cole, Strasburg, Ryu, Wheeler, all these guys deserve to get paid.
Yep.
They're valuable players, and, you know, they should not be waiting until March to get
like, good Lord, deal. Can we not have the timeline again where, like, Steven Strasburg is, like, hanging out, like, in, like, doing his own spring training? Like, God, I don't want that timeline. It's going to happen. Oh.
That was
Jason Vargas will be signed before Steven Strasburg.
Probably. Probably.
Oh my God, it's going to be by the Mets, isn't it? Oh God.
Fifth starter, well, Jason Vargas.
He's a fighter.
He's an innings eater.
He's a baseball player.
Yeah, he's an innings eater as he pitches five innings at a time.
Yep.
You know. Okay, so we are going to take a short break, and when we return, we are going to continue shifting the discussion toward wider baseball things and talk about the many things that have popped up in the, quote, stick to sports arena over the past, like, week or so. So stay tuned for that.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com. For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Back. So over the past week or so, a lot of things have happened. We keep saying that, like, you know, we're going to record every other week in the off season. It'll be fine because it's slow news during the off season. Well, nope, things keep happening. There was so much that we couldn't cover in the last podcast when we just went off about the Astros for an hour because, you know, that happened. So now we're going to cover a lot of the other stuff in that same vein. Between, you know, the president getting booed at the World Series and then, you know, the subsequent discourse that happened when the Nats visited the White House. Most of them did. Some of them did not, but most of them did. And bad things ensued from that. And, you know, on the other side of this same coin, the whole fall of Deadspin and, you know, the whole stick to sports narrative and how that kind of, you know, ruined Deadspin, which was a perfectly good sports website, and they killed it by asking their very good writers to stick to sports, and then the very good writers were like, "Welp, we want to write what we want," and they left, very bravely so. And the website is now kind of just a shell of a website. Didn't the guy in charge quit today? Not the guy who owns the website, but
the editorial director, Paul. I want to pronounce. Well, actually, I don't care if I pronounce it right or wrong, but Maidman. He quit after a weekend essentially of vlogging some of the worst but most unintentionally hilarious vlogs I've ever seen.
Yeah. So it's really good time to have Bradford on as someone who writes about sports for a living. So Bradford, what do you make of the whole, like, Deadspin thing and the whole stick to sports narrative? Like, what has been running through your mind as a journalist during this whole thing?
Ah, Jesus, so much anxiety, man. Like, yeah. You know, Deadspin was just given all of the drama that has happened with that website and with, you know, all the sister sites the last few years, that they were still existing and churning out good work despite, you know, the assault from many sides, including even their current owners, you know, this Van Feller era, that they were still doing good work, I thought was like incredibly encouraging to me. So it's very sad to see such a good and useful it actually is underdoing it, you know, a really vital part of the sports media ecosystem, to see them, you know, get tossed is tragic. It's tragic that we don't have the pointed but generally correct commentary about things like the president grabbing Kurt Suzuki by the boobs at the White House function. It's the investigative reporting that he did on so many subjects was, you know, broke open tons of massively important things or just silly things that were
excuse me, to read. Their investigation into whose penis was visible during the press conferences at the end of Johan Santana's no-hitter, that is the kind of journalism that just cannot be replicated any place else. That the mathematics behind that was really impressive.
I never read that, but I know what I'm going to Google next.
Yes.
So, but no, I have, but like from everything from like Mante Teo, you know, who, and his, you know,
his girlfriend,
for the high school, who, you know, vanished, to, you know, the reporting on Baylor and the culture of assault there, like, and so many of things that more things I've forgotten than I can remember, that's been really pushed forward. I'm clearly not an unbiased voice when I write. A lot of that is because of Deadspin, in so many ways, indirectly, because I think they changed the way how, you know, the way that people write and cover the sports that matter. But the way that people choose to cover sports in a way that matters, rather than just being a stenographer for whatever player or, you know, or coach or organization or billionaire. But also, directly, you know, my boss, Kyle Wagner, was a former Deadspinner. Kyle wrote an article in 2014 about Gamergate that is considered one of the seminal works of writing and journalism of, you know, this decade.
I read that piece.
It's an incredible, you know, longer piece about the Gamergate phenomena / crisis in 2014 or so, and it predicts, really, really, really prophesies about the kinds of controversies that we have today. You know, you can kind of see the shadows of that all in Gamergate, and you know, that was a Deadspin piece. One of my colleagues and editor, you know, Dennis, you know, another Deadspinner. Like, so I definitely feel like I try and carry the spirit of what they sought to do in my work. You know, I at a technical level, I enjoy writing with voice. I enjoy writing with, you know, attempting humor, hopefully nailing it more than most, you know, more often than not. Discussing the X's and O's of something, you know, but not being afraid to bring in a wider lens about what it means for the league. So when we're talking about trades or free agent signings, not just kind of like taking the sort of company lines that, you know, that were given about why a team, you know, chose not to spend money to improve the rotation, as we were just talking about a few minutes ago. That's the kind of thing that I try and discuss whenever I can, or when we have, you know, or when players are, accused of heinous things, that are, you know, credibly accused, I should say, you know, be actually call, you know, trying to see, you know, to find if it is a relevant part of the story, continuing to share that, you know, that's the kind of thing that you don't get in a lot, you know, in a whole lot of publications, but you got in Deadspin. And while I don't compare to, again, I'm not negging myself, but like, you know, while I'm not a Deadspin writer, like I definitely deeply appreciate them. But and then I'll try and land on a quick positive note with my little Deadspin monologue. But one of the things that I do admire about the team there is that they did not they rejected a destiny that the organization had handed to them, which was to stick to sports and to just kind of churn out stupid blogs that didn't actually say anything that matters. I really admire the bravery that of just kind of like quitting, quitting rather than pocketing checks while the Titanic sunk. But I think that is inspiring because it's very much a spirit of Deadspin to, I think, not just allow. There's a great Albert Bernico blog about. Again, not sports related whatsoever, but it was about when that man was dragged through the airplane. Do you remember that, Dr. David Dow? I want to say, and how there's so many people that, you know, that work for the airline that complied with the evil that was happening. They weren't the people who caused it for sure, you know, per se, but they, you know, but they allowed it to go on, you know, whether calling the authorities or, you know, or enforcing the stupid and discriminatory rules that airlines, you know, enforce, you know, but his whole point was that, it's essentially that you don't have to follow those rules. And that's what Deadspin did. They didn't follow the stupid, destructive, you know, edict from their company, but chose to put things in our own terms, you know, end things in our own terms, and that's kind of that's something I certainly I should qualify by saying I'm very happy at my job at the Daily News, but like, you know, but should stuff ever hit the fan, like I hope to have the kind of courage to be like, no, I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not going to play it safe and keep a job by doing what someone else, you know, who does not have the truth in the truth in view, wants me to do. I want to prioritize that before anything else. My morals, my convictions, and the public interest. So,
yeah, they refused to sell their souls. It was just awesome to watch. I mean, like, obviously, it was simultaneously really sad to watch the way it went down. But it was, you know, I also like admired their courage. And what you said about writing with voice, I really love that. And like, I really feel like the writers at Deadspin and your writing are the type of writing that, like, people like me, like, I try to emulate that. And, like, I like writing where you can cover up the byline and you can know whose writing it is. I feel like David Roth writes like that. He's, like, one of my, like, you know, Mets, like, writing heroes. Of course, we all love David Roth here because, you know, he writes about the Mets in such a way that, like, almost no one else can. And I feel like your writing is like that too, Bradford, where you could just like cover up the byline and I could be like, that's Bradford. I know that.
Shucks. Yeah. Thank you.
And that's a good thing. I think that that's good.
<laughs> You know? Well, I think what's sad is just the increasing dearth of such options. You know, it's not like Sports Illustrated was the most human of publications, but like certainly they had a lot of really, really talented writers before they gutted, like what, a month ago? Like,
yeah.
Talk about the news cycles going pretty quickly. I think it was basically a month ago that Sports Illustrated just like again gutted itself. And you've got The Athletic, which is a great publication and does get really true, like genuine voices in there. But I also, if you look at kind of, you know, it's basically like run by a bunch of hedge fund kind of guys. And like, that doesn't seem to be a recipe that works well for quality writing long-term. So I don't know. It's just, it's scary how it all fits in with the larger trends of where publishing seems to be headed.
Yeah, it was great to see they have a website that was at one point independently profitable. It was not being pumped up by shadow VC money.
Yeah.
And the unrealistic expectations that always come from when, you know, you get VC money, which is why there's always, you know, there seems to be a 5-7 year or 6 month life cycle for so many publications with promise, you know. It was, you know, they were profitable and they got attacked for you know, being themselves essentially, and that's, you know, and not just attack doesn't even is too tame a word. They were, you know, they were there was, you know, there was a plot to litigate them to their grave, and you know, and sadly that worked, but we need, you know, independent media that does not rely on some, you know, multimillionaires or billionaires to finance its day-to-day operations.
Yeah, it's just sad how these, like, rich ghouls just, like, gut these websites for parts and turn them into content farms. It's just extremely depressing. Like, and I think a big thing with a lot of people, like, I think the people that are on this podcast right now, is that it's not just about, like, the writing itself, even though, like, that's all incredible. It's about, like, I feel like I came of age in sports fandom by reading these sorts of articles. Yeah. And it made me the informed sports consumer that I am now. And that is hugely important in perpetuating, you know, the sorts of, like, the way we want to consume sports. And that isn't just in a stick to sports way. Like, I want to be an ethical, a moral consumer of sports. And that's what the goal of, like, you know, this podcast is, and what the goal of that type of writing is. And, like, I feel like when I, not even like when I was a kid, like literal growing up, like actually in my adult life, coming of age in sports fandom, reading the sorts of articles that were at Deadspin, like, it made me the sort of, like, consumer of sports that I am now. And it allows us to perpetuate, hopefully, like, bending a moral arc toward justice, so to speak, when it comes to, you know, how we think about sports as a part of a society and not something that exists in a bubble, that we could just stick to that and not talk about these wider issues that are these wider cultural issues that are super important.
Well, it's ironic, and, like, it's both ironic and yet obvious on its face that Deadspin would be where the question of stick to sports ultimately blows up, because Deadspin, like, steadfastly refused from the start to even consider the question of, like, should we be about sports or about politics? Because they just, like, flat out accepted the premise that, like, everything is politics. Politics is all over everything we do all the time. If you take even the most, like, minuscule second to consider it. And so Deadspin just never, they were never like, we should have more articles about politics, or, you know, we should try to separate our sports from blah, blah, blah. Cause that just doesn't make sense to them as a reflection of the world. Cause of, like, of course sports are political. We have a podcast right here where we talk about the political side of sports all the time. Like, it's just, they don't even see there as being a particular point to the question. Oh, they did, I should say. This is all different now.
Well, even, like, at the parade, well, like Bradford mentioned, Suzuki being groped by the president in front of...
Oh, boy.
In front of the, and then he was like, oh, I didn't think it would be political. It was just about us winning the World Series. Dude, like, you don't get to put on a Make America Great hat again and then just say, oh, no, it's not political. Like, you can't have it... Like, you were making a statement by putting that hat on. Does he not realize that?
Well, that's also, I just gotta say, because this is the thing where they're like, oh, it's about respecting the office of the presidency.
Yes.
He did not put on an office of the presidency hat. He put on a Trump campaign hat. That is, like, the most, like, baldly political statement that one could possibly have made in that context. Like, it is just utterly and completely political. Like, there's no other content to it of any kind. Jesus Christ.
I think that there is the possibility, though slim, that Kurt Suzuki did it ironically.
Okay. He doesn't seem like the smartest person I've ever met.
Like, you know, just kind of the quote unquote dude, bro. Doing it as like a bro, yo, give me a hat. Come on, give me a hat. No, it'll be funny. Come on, everyone's gonna love it. You know, that's what I heard. Like, in my mind, as I was reading the text message, you know, interview, whatever, you know, where he defended himself, and even saw him, you know, again, doing Titanic or whatever, but the R-rated version, you know, with the president. So, like, you know, just it all being a gag. But even that, like, not, I don't even think that delineating the motivation matters in any real material way. Because we know what the hat is actually for, and whether you did it out of idiocy or ignorance or, you know, genuine commitment, like doctrinal commitment to the ideology espoused, by the president in the phrasing that led to the, you know, famous hat, it don't really matter. But again, if only there was a website that specialized in breaking that kind of thing down. In a quick, timely, hilarious, and poignant way.
Yeah. I wonder what website that could be.
Yeah.
Bradford, you talked about like a couple of like specific like Deadspin articles that were, you know, like sort of sea changes and like really important articles. And one that I just want to give a mention to that I think of when I think of Deadspin is Lindsay Adler's article in Deadspin about the guy who posed as a 13-year-old girl on a sports blog the 13-year-old
girl. No, it's a girl.
Oh,
yeah.
The other way, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Who posed as a married man on a sports blog and did that, you know, and took that act way too far and did it for a long time. That article was kind of like, that's kind of when I sort of became like, went from a casual Deadspin reader to being like a fan of Deadspin and reading like a lot more of their stuff. Because that article was like wild. And that's the sort of stuff that you couldn't find anywhere besides at Deadspin. Yeah. That I feel like is getting lost now. So I just wanted to give that article a quick shout because Lindsay was on the show a little while back, and that's like my favorite piece of writing that she's ever done because it's really, really good. And if you haven't read it, you should.
No, I remember reading that with my jaws to the floor. And you know what? I should say I said a lot about Deadspin. I feel like Deadspin wouldn't want me to lionize Deadspin. You know, there was a lot of mistakes made. You know, no website of course is perfect, but like, you know, but I think one of the things that was, I did appreciate them, you know, about them is that they did seem to try and evolve from like, you know, the, you know, perhaps the more bro-y immaturity of, you know, their first few years of, you know, existence, where it was like, you know, liberal politics with a sprinkling of stoolie sort of like, you know.
Yeah, they definitely had a South Parkish vibe early on.
Yeah. Again, I an ironic distancing of, you know, misogyny or racism even. But there was a whole lot of growth and a lot of meaningful journal. I think my favorite series of Deadspin articles was Greg Howard's on the Undefeated. Have you guys ever read those?
I haven't.
No.
Oh my goodness. So y'all need to Google this, but Greg Howard, who was a former New York Times journalist before that Deadspin, he wrote this. He wrote a series of exposés, essentially, on the early days of the Undefeated, and particularly Jason Whitlock, who was the who helped create the website, but had produced like maybe like three articles over the first like 2 years of his existence because he's an incompetent idiot. But he can talk and he can barely talk, and complain about like Colin Kaepernick, you know, being rightfully angry about police violence. And so he has a TV show on Fox Sports. But Jason Whitlock essentially got driven out of the undefeated, which is now at least a respectable site. you know, no place is perfect, of course, but like, you know, but now they have competent leadership, you know, they produce good work worth reading about, the black experience within sports. Before that, they were being run to the ground by an idiot, and, you know, and Jace, and it was Greg Howard, who was about our age, you know, I guess he's probably in his early 30s now, you know, like, but it was maybe in his 20s when, you know, when he wrote these articles, just kind of breaking down everything went wrong in hilarious fashion, and in a way that dramatically changed ESPN's approach to one of their flagship, you know, projects in recent years. So that's probably one of my favorite, you know, like pieces of journalism from Deadspin. I definitely, you know, encourage you all to read that.
Yeah, definitely gonna go back and read that. So I guess the like final thing that we'll talk about on this whole like stick to sports theme is, I'm curious what you think, Bradford, and actually what Linda and Maggie think about this too, because like I've been thinking a lot about this. Like, why do you think that this is kind of all like coming to a head now, and all of these things are dovetailing at once, and why this like is like kind of boiling over in this moment? Do you think it's like the unique culture of the Trump era that's driving it? Do you think that there are other factors? Like, why do you think that this is kind of all coming to a head in this exact moment in time?
I mean, it's hard to like come up with like a grand unifying theory for why everything sucks.
That could also be a title of the podcast.
I was just thinking that.
It's hard to say why, you know, amoral idiots run the world, except for, you know, that's the way the earth is all kind of always spun to some degree. And then there are people that that hopefully rebel against it, and then they usually lose, and life keeps going. That's so nihilistic. I'm not that nihilistic, I promise. But I do think that as far as just the media in general, that people do feel a sense of a lack of shame in the way that like honest independent media is sort of attacked in, you know, in just kind of sort of the broader culture, the whole like, you know, fake news, but like, you know, but the cynical, sarcastic deployment of fake news, or not sarcastic, but, you know, but cynical, disingenuous deployment of fake news towards actual, you know, good reporting, metastasized by capitalism, I guess, you know, people having the money to shut down the things that they don't like. Until you kind of solve those problems, which I guess is sin nature slash money, you're always going, you know, it's not going to really go away anytime soon. I would love to figure out some sort of nonprofit method towards creating a good sports site. It's at least currently above my pay grade, but, you know, but shoot, if anyone wants a brainstorm, that could be the next pod, how to save the free press. That's kind of my farting out some thoughts.
Yeah. And I think it's easy to feel like pretty hopeless about this whole thing, because I just feel like me as just like a sports fan who like likes to consume sports media and like blogs about the Mets, like I just feel like I have very little power to change all of this, but like the only thing I feel like I can do is like keep writing the sort of stuff that I want to write and keep doing this podcast and just like, you know, tweeting to my like very small Twitter audience, like into the void about like these things. Like, I don't know what else to do. Like what can we do? I don't know.
I think that's honestly, you know, what's the serenity prayer, you know, God help me to know, to control what, you know, to know what I can control. I am completely
accept that things
right
I cannot change.
Accept what you can't change. Change what you can, and know the difference. I think those are the
beautifully said. Yeah.
Yes.
Wonderful. So
go on a T-shirt.
Do that. And part of that is, you know, it is for people who, you know, have the thoughts, which, you know, not everyone has the thoughts to actually be, you know, that you know, a lot of people who are writing don't actually have a framework, a moral framework to assess the way the world works. Sadly, that is incredibly true within baseball media.
Oh boy, that is true.
But you know, but for those that do, you know, to continue fighting a good fight by faithfully, accurately writing and reporting about things that matter. You know, get the information out while you can. If you have the income, the disposable income to help institutions that do it, you know, that do report the truth, please support them. Consider a subscription to you know, your independent, your local media. I can recommend a newspaper if you need it.
I mean, I would say supporting your publication, your preferred publications financially. In any case, like, I would say if you find yourself kind of bummed out for like the 10th time that week that a link to Baseball Prospectus was for subscribers only, it's time to subscribe. Like, support. There are not that many institutions that are trying to make this work, but those that are, they need readers and often deserve readers even better. And like, I found myself really wanting to share more and more like Baseball Prospectus and The Athletic and other publications out there that do charge for the work that their writers are doing. And I think like that model we all need to be okay with that model. It's an important one.
And, you know, be a fan of stuff, but also like be honest about, you know, about when publications you like really mess up. And that, you know, that applies to me as like terrifying as it is to say out loud, like, you know, but like when, you know, but though I will never fail you ever in the hypothetical chance that, you know, where I don't get something wrong on or rather don't get something right, whether it's from small things to, you know, to big things, like, please, like, be honest and, you know, keep publications and writers and editors, you know, accountable for the mistakes. And that applies to, you know, whatever you read, you know, so that we can do, you know, good work. And that's, you know, that's vital that the sort of trust with the public, like, remains, because so much trust is eroded in, you know, in the media period, you know, and rightfully so. Like I don't even think it's entirely wrong. You know, there's a cynical Trumpy deployment of it, but then there's also complete failures to accurately, fairly, morally report on issues impacting communities outside of the mostly white newsrooms that are, you know, dominate this country. There are, you know, again, we see that in the baseball media with the way we get domestic violence issues wrong so often. We get, you know, issues of, you know, racial injustice so wrong, where, you know, where either we don't comment on it or we don't have the range to comment on it. That's a, you know, that is rightfully alienated so many people that could be, you know, reading and supporting if they believe that they were being heard. And so I strongly encourage people to be as passionate a critic as they are a voracious reader of what we do.
Yeah. And I would say, I would add to that and say, if you are criticizing someone for what they've put out there in the world, And they are someone that you usually like what they put out in the world. Criticize in good faith. Argue in good faith always. Like, I mean, obviously there are people who are not writing in good faith, so I'm not talking about those folks. if the person's not making their initial argument in good faith, that's totally different. But if a person is writing in good faith and making an argument in good faith that you happen to disagree with for whatever reason, and you think that they've made an honest mistake and their heart is in the right place, but they've made an honest mistake for whatever reason, just because they're ignorant of the way a certain community experiences the world, or they've just, you know, made an error because we're human, then make the argument in good faith and, you know, don't just like scream like "you suck" at them, because that's not gonna help the discourse. So there's that. These should be like conversations rather than, you know, people screaming at each other.
Yeah, I largely recommend, you know, some level of basic kindness.
Have you seen the internet before? It feels like you might be new.
I know, right? Yeah, I got to just open up my MacBook now. But no, I mean, you know, basic kindness is nice, but you know, even, you know, but I would rather, I personally, me Bradford, would, I've gotten to a point where, like, I think sometimes a lot of times things aren't said because we're so afraid of, like, you know, offending our friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like the good guys, yeah, we're like, you know, we might be a little more polite with and then just gossip about them in the DMs. But the bad guys are like, oh yeah, F this dude, you know. I actually try and make a point of responding to like hate mail. you know, which you get a lot of when you work for a tabloid. I'm pretty new to like, I just say again, because for those who don't know me, but I'm pretty new to, you know, full-time staff writing for, you know, a publication. I've done it before off and on, but like, you know, but it's probably the most stable, which is not saying a lot because it's still, you know, media, but stable job I've had in this space. So I'm learning a whole lot, you know, but it's been one of those things that keep me honest, is just kind of like, you know, giving someone, even, you know, so long as someone doesn't say something belligerently racist to me, like, I really, you know, don't mind, just hearing, oh, well, you know, I disagree with you, but I'm grateful that you took the time to talk to me, because it forces me to think about what I'm saying, and, you know, and you keep me in business. So, so by all means, like, you know, don't be an asshole, excuse my language, but like, you know, but be, you know, but be honest, even to your friends. So. Yeah. Yeah. Even the good people, the good guys in media, whoever he or she or they may be.
Yeah, that's important. Okay, so we are going to take one more break, and when we get back, we will end this show, which has had a lot of, you know, depressing content with lighthearted moments, with a lighthearted moment. So stay tuned for that.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
And we are back. We are going to end the show like we always do with walk-off wins, where each of us talks about what is making us happy this week, baseball related or otherwise. Maggie, what is your walk-off win for this week?
All right. Well, I don't want to overcommit, but early looks like the election day results are a walk-off win. But in any case, sticking to sports. Oh, wait, I'm not sticking to sports now either. Halloween is my walk-off win. I had the closest thing in Manhattan you will have to the classic trick-or-treating experience of we picked the kids up and we took them to this stretch of street that closes off to traffic. And it's just all these townhouses, and they get super, super into it with tons of decorations. And we went a couple years ago, and I was really excited because both the kids are trick-or-treating age. And we just had an amazing time. The weather held out. I had ponchos, literally handmade ponchos from garbage bags ready to go. And we didn't have to use them at all. And my kids were the most polite ones there. They said thank you constantly. Aww. And I was so proud. And they loved their costumes. Ellie loved her costume because it was the one that Tommy wore 2 years ago. He had been Moana, and then she wanted to be Moana. So that was wonderful for my crafting time that I just did not have to do anything for her. And then Tommy, I built a Fortrain costume because he's just decided that he loves the Fortrain, which sure, whatever. And it was amazing. It was a great, classic 5-year-old and 2-year-old Halloween. And it was a darn good time. So happy belated Halloween to everybody.
We'll definitely have to sidebar and get those pictures.
Oh, yes. There will be pictures.
Yes.
Halloween's the best. I love Halloween. I might be biased about that because Halloween is 2 days after my birthday, but I love Halloween, which kind of brings me to my walk-off win, which I think I share with Linda this week.
Yes, you do.
So my walk-off win has to do with my birthday, which happened, we actually recorded the last podcast on my birthday. So we were recording on my birthday last week. But over the weekend between last week and this week, I had a friend's birthday celebration. It was really nice. I went up to White Plains, hung out with Michael and his mom. His mom made me dinner, and it was really nice. And then the next day, Michael and I hung out with Linda and Kellyanne. So we had an Amazing Avenue friend's birthday.
Hey.
It was very fun. We did brunch. We had too many mimosas at brunch, and it was wonderful. Oh, yes.
That's the right number.
Yes. Amazing Avenue Slack got to receive our drunk slacks. It was fantastic. And then we went and did an escape room, and we escaped. So, hell yeah.
With 49 seconds left.
49 seconds left. The escape room was no match for 3 librarians and a scientist.
Well, so, yeah. If I can move on to my walk-off, piggybacking off of that. But it's such a rush going through one of those things.
I've always wanted to try.
Oh, you have to do it. It's so much fun. Just taking, seemingly...
I would die for a puzzle.
Well, this, you could have almost died because technically you were being held hostage by a creepy surgeon. You had to get out of there before he killed you.
I love it. I'm there.
Yeah, So it was seeing how unrelated things in the room related to each other, and because I just kept shouting, "Everything we need is right here. What aren't we seeing?" So yeah, but then when you figure it out, you just feel so accomplished, and it's just exciting, and I'm so glad we did it, and I'm so glad you had fun, Allison, and thank you for inviting me too. I had such a blast hanging out with you guys.
Yeah, it was so fun. I guess I was the only escape room veteran in the group because everyone else, it was their first escape room. It was my 4th or 5th escape room because I love them. And so
I want to go back.
Yeah, we should go back. They have 3 other rooms. So it was, really fun to not only actually do the escape room because that was amazing, but it was fun to watch Linda, Kellyanne, and Michael experience their first escape room because Kellyanne was "We gotta write everything down. We gotta write everything down. Where's the marker?" And Linda was "Everything relates." It was just really funny.
Escape rooms, man. I went with my nieces and nephew. We won with a point 2 seconds.
Whoa!
Yeah, so it felt like a 24 episode. Because they had that. I think they even used the same sound effects. That was cool.
I will say, I think you reverted to waterboarding just a little too quickly.
Yeah, maybe. So, Bradford, what is your walk-off win?
My walk-off win. Let's see. I'll share two cool things that happened. They're very one would have more consequential, one less so. The more consequential thing was I got to cover actually a basketball game for my first time as a member of the press. So that was cool. So I was at the Knicks.
It wasn't the Knicks, was it?
No, it was not the Knicks. Okay. It was a team with hope and promises.
It might be more of a punishment if it was the Knicks.
I was actually at a Brooklyn Nets game last night. They were playing the Pelicans. I initially marked it on my calendar because of the Uber prospect Zion Williamson. Very excited to see him and possibly ride off of, off of that. But, Zion got hurt. Started, so it wasn't meant to be. But it was, it was a fun experience and hopefully an opportunity to broaden my own coverage and I hope to write about kind of anything I like, and do it well. So it was good to get my feet wet in NBA locker room and stuff like that. And so I was really grateful for that. Other thing I'm grateful for, other walk-off win, was I just had a really good slice of pizza today.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Where?
Just so you know, Maggie, since a fellow Uptowner.
Yeah, we're neighbors.
Yeah, it's a place called Lucille's. It's on it's on like 150th and McCombs. So it's weirdly not the most transit accessible because it's in that part of Harlem that's like not elevated by like hills, yes. or Washington Heights, and so like the D train gets you there, the 2-3 gets you there. Perhaps there's a bus. I don't know, but I can walk there. I just have to walk down a hill and then up a hill. But yeah, so Lucille's is it's owned by actually the guy who, Alex Trebek's son is.
Whoa! Okay.
Oh, that guy!
Wow.
He has a couple of coffee shops, in the neighborhood. They're all. Like many new businesses, attracting, I guess, the newer residents of, Harlem that don't reflect the older community. But the pizza is very good. I cannot hate on that. And so, and it's probably the best pizza I've had since moving to Harlem about, Harlem / Washington Heights the last 5 years. I've been dying for a good slice because I grew up in Queens. So you can just trip over good pizza in the outer boroughs. But Manhattan, besides like being in like Little Italy and, some of the neighborhoods, most of it's kind of bad, like relative to the city. But not Lucille's. Lucille's is actually like borderline like destination pizza. So I'm not a brand sponsor of Lucille's, but I can't be bought. So if anyone's listening, Michael Trebek.
What toppings did you get?
I just got pepperoni, man.
I love pepperoni.
Yeah, just my go. I get pepperoni almost every time. I've become a regular there. But they might be on the Slice app though.
They deliver to my office,
Maggie.
Oh my god, they're
on man.
Okay, we get a Podo pizza party.
Yes, let's do it
right. At my office.
At Maggie's office.
I'm down.
I'll meet you at the lobby so I can scan you in with my ID, I guess.
Oh, let's go.
Good times.
I'm telling you guys, after not living in the in the metro area for a while, like coming back, that was like the thing I missed the most was good pizza. Because Baltimore is a really, really good food scene, actually. I really loved the food there. And they had decent pizza if you're looking for the fancy Napolitan style of fancy pizza, but when you're looking for by the slice size of your face, that just doesn't exist in Baltimore,
right?
And so the second I moved back to Jersey, I was like, pizza. So anywhere I can get a good slice, I'm like totally down. I'm milking this year that I'm back in Jersey for all it's worth, because I don't know where I'm going to be after this year. So,
oh my God, it looks so good. I'm sorry, I'm just sitting here looking at pizza pictures.
Yeah. That's a great way to end one's day, honestly. To just like...
an all beef meatball lathered in a spicy arrabbiata sauce set over ricotta cheese.
Do they deliver to Westchester?
For enough money, babe, they'll deliver anywhere.
Yeah, okay. Right.
I don't know that that's true. I'm just saying that it is.
What is your price?
I mean, I'll deliver it to you for a certain price.
A small
I'll give you
fee.
A good tip.
my freelancing rate, I'll figure out what that is.
Freelance pizza deliverer. That's a good backup career in case
that's
I'm not.
That's a good side business.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that actually is like literally a whole lot of people's backup side gigs nowadays.
Well, I mean, I like Uber Eats,
Grubhub. Yeah.
That's the glory of the gig economy. We all need a side hustle. Yeah.
And that's why they're going to carry me from Columbia University feet first. Give me that old school standard issue employment, please. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So Bradford, it was so great to have you on. We really appreciate your time. Where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
Okay. Well, I have a terrible Twitter handle. It starts in an underscore. I'm sorry, but, underscore B E E W I L L Y. So B Willie, cause my byline is Bradford William Davis. So, that's my bad Twitter handle. But I love the post. Yes, right. Only thing I need is like a seven digits behind that, and an egg. But no, So I love the post, and you know I do it often. So you can catch me there. You can catch me at the New York Daily News. You know, I'm writing there regularly. Most you know usually baseball, but you know, but with some dives into other sports as well. Yeah, I'm around. As Maggie knows, I'll grab a cup of coffee if you ever want to talk sports or not sports. And, happy to just kind of connect with the greater local sports fan community so I can do my job the best I can.
Fantastic. We're not sticking to sports on this podcast. We'll talk about anything. So you should follow Bradford and you should read his writing if you aren't already. So do so. Also please follow Amazing Avenue. We are on all the social medias, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can follow our show on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own. You can follow each of the hosts on Twitter. I am at Petite PhD. Where are you, Maggie?
At Maggie162.
And you, Linda?
At Linda Servage.
Follow all of us on Twitter. Follow the show on Twitter. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review the show. It really helps people find it. The original music for the intro and this outro to this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go Mets, and don't forget, there is no crime in the